From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm David Strever, guest hosting for Evan Dawson. Like many of you, I am incredibly curious about artificial intelligence. Do you remember when your phone first started suggesting replies for you to your texts? The first time I saw it, it was about a text from a friend suggesting we get dinner. And my immediate thought was, how soon until my phone makes its own plans? We're getting there. Predictive software and algorithm technology has rapidly advanced, and people in my industry are really starting to worry it's not that far away from replacing us. As a journalist and a programmer, I see benefits and challenges to it that will change my industry and probably our entire society. My guests today also see that. Today we have Felix M. Simon. He is a research fellow in AI and news at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, all the way over at the University of Oxford. He spent 4 years researching AI in the news. He interviewed about 170 industry experts and published a major paper, Artificial Intelligence in the News. He's here to talk about his findings and explain what we're seeing now and where it might go from here. Felix, thank you for joining us from London.
Thank you for having me.
We are also joined by Jason Samuel Lucas. He is an expert in information technology and disinformation. He is at Pennsylvania State University, and he's just published another paper, The Long-Tail Impact of Generative AI on Disinformation, in which he argues that AI poses a major risk, especially during crises like the current weather situation we have in the South and in any resource-limited setting. He is here to talk about how AI can feed into disinformation campaigns that we've already been seeing on social media for years, and how people might use it to cause confusion or sow discord. Jason, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure having me, and I'm happy to be here. And nice to meet you, Felix, as well.
Nice to meet you as well.
So you guys already know each other, right? Your paper, Jason, was in response to part of Felix's paper, and I want to get to that in just a few minutes. But Felix, I just want to start with you, because I looked at the timeline on your paper. You started this before ChatGPT and kind of the current AI hype. What got you into it? When did you realize just how big this topic was going to be?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. In many ways, I started first on this topic in 2019, and part of the reason was I used to be a journalist myself, and then slowly moved into academia. And when I began my PhD, it was sort of one of the questions was what should I study in? Because I'd always been interested in technological change in the news. AI sort of seemed like a reasonably interesting topic at the time, but it was certainly sort of not the big hype topic that it is today in many ways. So I kind of got started in that and worked away in a fairly small community of scholars and people working on this at the time. And I'd say it was sort of, it became clear over time that there was something there, that there was something bigger, but even I was slightly surprised by the big public reception to foundation models, and especially large language models as ChatGPT, when that publicly dropped for the first time, November 2022.
And can you give a couple examples of the types of uses you found in your report? Like just very high level, like what types of things are, where is AI right now in the news industry?
Sure. I mean, in many ways, it's been there for quite a while. If you sort of conceptualize AI as a very broad thing, which is about machine learning and sort of computer systems being able to learn and improve over time, in some cases unsupervised. And you've got plenty of examples, even from 10 years ago, where that was being used in recommendation systems, which basically recommend content to you as a user, increasingly also in some cases of news production. So, for instance, structured articles, sports results, financial results. There have been AI applications as early as 2014. A lot of dynamic tables we see, the New York Times is a good example. That is, in many ways, AI under the hood, because there is sort of a prediction model working away. And in recent years, it sort of has moved more strongly into editorial and sort of traditionally journalistic work. So take transcription. It feels very mundane. It sounds very mundane. But up until a couple of years ago, transcribing audio with computers was still very, very difficult. And these days, it's something I can do on my iPhone, sort of on the go. And of course, journalists are using that too. So this is sort of just some of the examples where AI has been used and is being used in news organizations. And we see that increasingly, both in production and distribution for various tasks.
We actually use that right now. We use a tool called Otter, which does transcription. We use it for this talk show. We use it for interviews. People at NPR use it all day long. It's absolutely a big part of the workflow. That I, when I first started as a journalist, had to transcribe from my recorder. So I learned very quickly to keep my interviews short. And now I feel much better doing a long interview because I know I've got a software that will kind of take away that grunt work for me.
And it does save a lot of time at the end of the day. I think that's something I've even realized in my own work. I mean, I do occasionally transcribe stuff, and it is such a pain save in so many ways.
Well, and so I took your... Google has an AI researcher tool, Notebook LM. I actually took your report. I copied the whole thing. I saved it as a PDF and I uploaded it to this tool and I asked it to make a 9-minute podcast version. So I'm going to ask Rob and Megan now if they could play a little clip. This is also online. The full thing is online at wxxinews.org. So, you know, if you're out there and you don't really know the capabilities and you're enticed by this little 20-second teaser we're going to play, go on there and hear the whole thing and take it away, Rob.
All right, so you want to dive into AI in journalism.
Let's do it.
Not just the, you know, robot reporter headlines.
Yeah.
But the real deal. We're going deep on that today. Dissecting this Columbia Journalism Review report. Artificial intelligence in the news.
Oh.
And they really go beyond the hype.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing right now. What's your immediate reaction when you hear that? What does that make you think?
I was sort of intrigued, and it sounded like someone was dying there. It's quite impressive, actually. I mean, it's a bit stilted and sort of not actually supernatural, but it is very impressive in terms of how it sort of has this conversation that feels very human-like.
Jason, what do you think when you hear that? What's your first reaction to that?
I mean, I think it's very interesting that the technology can produce such quality audio of his transcript, or Felix's writing. And it's not surprising. These technology are increasingly becoming better and better at sounding like humans, sounding more realistic, and more convincing in their stories.
And for the people at home, for everyone, really, if you do go and listen to this whole thing, my favorite part, they say, they bring up the Hotel California paradox. And the male host voice says, you know, you're going to have to refresh my memory on the Hotel California. And the other host does the opening line to the song. And then they explain how that connects back to your paper. And that was the one thing about it I genuinely was actually impressed by. You know, of course, just like the kind of natural interplay sound of the two hosts. But I did. That was a part that felt a little bit magical to me when they pulled out the lyrics. Are you familiar with the Hotel California song, Felix? Does that have any memories for you?
I am, and I think part of the reason why I might sort of come up with this is because I sort of refer to that in the report itself at some point. It's sort of one of my favorite pieces of music, and also I think I use it as an analogy somewhere, maybe. So that might be the reason, but yes, I do know it.
I found it in your report, and I was like, wow, it really did. It feels significant in the writing, and the AI picked up on that as well. Jason, I want to ask you, so we just heard some of the ways that AI is being used right now in the news. Can you talk about some ways that AI is being used for disinformation right now? Are there any maybe current ones you can point to that people might be familiar with?
Yeah, currently AI are being used to spread disinformation in different world events. Like we can look at the Russian-Ukraine war. We can look at the Palestine-Israel conflict. And there's different cases in different elections globally on the Africa continent, like Nigeria. And in some cases in the United States, you see snippets of the use of generative AI to create disinformation and to help propagate some narrative that impacts some subjective bias or human disposition to convince them or to deter them to do something or to feel a way about a particular thing. And that's the whole effect of the disinformation campaign.
Yeah, I think Hurricane Milton, I've seen family members of mine have shared, very quickly shared the images of Disney World being taken away by the storm, right? And that, of course, that did not happen. Disney World is still there. But someone created that, and it went pretty viral pretty quickly, right?
Yeah, I'm actually in Florida right now. it's beautiful here. I'm in the southern part. The hurricane did some damage in the northern part, which is far away from Disney World. And there has been disinformation being spread about the hurricane, very much politically motivated. Right now, there have been a few of that in the news. So I think people should be aware of it. And
And I think a photo, one fake photo, right? This is obviously this can catch someone's attention, but probably that can get disproven pretty easily. But then I do think about something like, as silly as it is, that fake podcast I generated. I made that in 10 seconds. I think somebody with more time, maybe a motive to disinform people, could tweak that, make it sound like someone else, add some extra clips to it from the real news, right? You could probably make something that sounds really real in just a couple hours. Do you think there's a possibility that people will not be able to tell between real news and AI-generated fake news in the near future?
Yeah, I think currently some people will not be able to distinguish between the two. Especially, usually when someone hears news, they're not sometimes focused on the actual news. Is basically the narrative or the messaging and how that impacts the way they feel. So they don't try to verify that information. They don't look at it. You get it on your phone, on social media. You may choose to ingest it or not. And I think it's going to become much difficult in the future to distinguish between what is real or what is synthetic. And what is synthetic can be disinformation. It can actually be real news. So it's going to be very difficult to know the difference.
What do you think about that, Felix? I know you looked at current uses. What about the potential for abuse? Have you done much research on that?
Sure. I do agree with some of the points Jason is making. It is becoming incredibly difficult these days to sort of distinguish between what is sort of, truly human or what is sort of sounding like a human or looking like a human, but completely AI generated. I think that's definitely something that these technologies have enabled. I'm some a bit more skeptical, as Jason will know, on the sort of massive sort of implications that some people sort of seem to expect from this. I'm not saying that it is not a problem. I think that's very important to state clearly. I think it can be used to mislead. It can be potentially more convincing in some contexts, but I currently don't see a lot of reasons to believe that it's sort of the big, big game changer that some people sort of argued is. And there's various reasons for that, which we can probably get into at some point. But it is quite frankly astounding what the technology enables us to do and enables various actors to do. And as the technology progresses, I think that will sort of continue.
Yeah, well, one of the things I've done in my work as a journalist with a digital programming background is I've tried to help and train journalists in writing for the machines as well as writing for humans. So we write an article, then we also need some of the reporters at this station they're shaking their fists right now if they're listening. Then you have to you write your headline. You have to make sure your headline works for a human. Then you have to go in the back end and write stuff for the search engines. You have to write a search engine headline description. And for the people at home who aren't connected to the journalism industry, this has become kind of an existential thing because most people aren't just going to a local news website anymore. They're looking at Google or Facebook or TikTok or some other algorithmically generated feed of information. And that feed needs to know to give them our news. So we have to put in these little tips for the machine. I've actually recently started consulting for CMS developers working on a AI-powered new CMS, Labrador, which is pretty cool, and it automates all of that stuff. And so I'm already seeing, you know, this is not creating news, but it's taking a well-researched, well-reported article. The reporter who's done the interviews just copies and pastes it in, and then it's giving them, here's your SEO, here's your regular headline, here's your description. It's kind of automating that stuff for them to make it work better. Is that the type of thing that you're seeing instead of this like transformation of AI reporting all the news and doing it all? Is that more of what you're seeing, Felix, these kind of helper tools that that assist us?
I think this is certainly what we can say. So from the empirical material that's available, that this is what a lot of news organizations internationally are looking at. Partially because it is very difficult to replace the sort of fundamental act of reporting news. I mean, yes, you can automate some parts of that. Take again transcription. If you are out in the field doing an interview with someone during Hurricane Milton, you can have that transcribed so it can aid you in the act of reporting. But the fact that you still need someone like yourself going to somewhere in Florida, for instance, or to somewhere in the war zone, meet people, identify people that would be interesting to talk to, and then gain that trust and get them to speak to you, for instance, or to go to a courthouse and sort of dig into the facts. That's not something a machine can easily do for you. That's not something you can sort of automate away quickly. So in many ways, lots of news organizations are looking at this, especially on the production side, for those tasks where it is, okay, how can we use the technology to speed up certain processes, to aid reporters in what they are doing day in, day out, and sort of take away some of the grunt work.
And so I just want to let people know who are just tuning in. I'm David Strever. I'm sitting in for Evan Dawson. This is Connections, and we are talking about the benefits and dangers of AI for journalism. I have two experts here, Jason Lucas, and that was just Felix Simon, talking about their research. If you have questions about the technology, about the implications, or just comments or feedback, you can call us 1-844-295-TALK and let us know what you're thinking. Yeah, so that is those kinds of helper roles do seem to be the current one. For the industry, you know, my big fear is getting replaced with a machine and not having a job anymore. And the one thing that I find a little bit heartening is something that came up in your paper, which is the current financial situation of journalism is not good. The model more and more seems to be kind of this NPR public media model where people are actually paying for the information as opposed to relying on advertisers or, you know, corporate funding. And part of me is heartened by that because I just think it's going to be very hard for that AI podcast I generated. I might listen to that. I would never pay money for that. I wouldn't subscribe or donate to that. Do you think, outside of just that model, do you think AI in journalism is going to have a bad economic outcome for the industry, or is it something that could help it?
I think that's one of the cases where, as a social scientist, I would have to give the sort of classic answer: it depends. In many ways, there are early attempts to use AI to sort of help the sort of economic side. I mean, for instance, better matching adverts with users and content on news media's properties. AI can help with that and is being used. Finding better ways of improving subscription models and getting people to actually pay for news. That is certainly something that is being used across the industry. The thing is, in many ways, if it will have sort of positive or negative economic impact, it also depends a lot on what other actors are doing with AI beyond the news. And this is sort of where lots of news organizations are currently, for good reasons, worried because, for instance, if you look at something like Google's AI-generated search replies, that is something which could potentially take away even more traffic from news organizations, which they used to receive if someone searched for something, but receive a link. That link led to, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post or Fox News or any other sort of website which has advertising. If that is sort of declining because certain people are satisfied with that automatically generated answer, then of course that is going to have negative implications for the news. The problem is it's sort of still a developing field. We don't yet know what platform companies, but also the new entrants like OpenAI, Perplexity, are doing, what kind of products they will build, and how audiences will also receive and accept those products. That's sort of still very much in the air. One thing we do know from recent international research at the Reuters Institute is that, at least for the news, people are not particularly willing to pay for AI-generated news. They often don't mind if AI sort of assists in the production, especially for back-end tasks, but they really sort of, at least in the surveys we run, take a quite negative view when it comes to news being completely produced by AI and then having to pay for it. That's something lots of people don't want. I think that's just something for the news industry also to be mindful of.
And we have to take a short break. When we come back, we will have more with both of our guests. And I really want to dive into that one, actually, because that gets to an earlier question I had, Felix. And I think we're going now. I'm David Strever, filling in for Evan Dawson. Coming up in our next hour, we are talking about Dungeons & Dragons. After Stranger Things became a Netflix hit, it seemed like everybody was talking about the game. Now, D&D is celebrating its 50th birthday, and we have an in-studio panel to talk about why the hobby is stronger than ever, where it's been, and where it's going. And we're taking your calls and answering all your questions. That's next hour. I'm David Strever, sitting in for Evan Dawson. We are talking about AI and journalism, and Felix Simon and Jason Lucas are here with us. They are researchers who have studied this. And Felix and I were just having I thought that was a very interesting thing that Felix brought up about their finding, which is that people don't want to pay for AI news. This brings me back to two questions, but I'll start with the first one. And this is for, I'll start with you, Jason. What do you think it matters to people if they can't tell the AI from the real person? Like, do you think that's a sticking point for people? Did that come up at all in your work?
No, but one of the things is when it comes to AI is, you know, the return on investment for this technology, it's one of the biggest questions. And the market power really control that. And that would be unique to the news industry. How does people benefit from this technology? And I think there's, you know, mixed emotions on it, and there's hardly any way to tell how people can make money from this technology. At this moment, it's just most likely an efficiency and speed tool. It can be used for personalization. It can provide real-time insight, make your job much better. But it's, at this time, I think it's pretty much hard to tell.
Well, so that gets me then back to you, Felix, which is, people don't want to pay for AI, and the AI news, like the example of that Google snippet, that only exists as long as there are journalists working who are producing that news, right? So I think this is maybe at the heart of kind of the, you said you kind of had that both sides answer there, that classic ambiguous answer, right? Like when people aren't paying for this, if it's not going, what will Google even be pulling from for that? Is that going to, do you see that as a potential big factor down the road?
I mean, it could be to some extent, but I think there's some important caveats there. So I think you're correct in saying that factually reported information comes from news organizations and feeds into those systems. There are currently big open questions about the use of that data by developers of AI models, if that was sort of legal under fair use conditions, or if it's actually a breach of copyright. And that's something, I mean, we can't get into that right here, but it is true that for these systems to work and to at least reply with sort of news-related information, they need news to draw on. But then again, a lot of the things people do search for online are not necessarily news-related. And there's lots of other data which is publicly available for good reason, which might be or is being ingested into those systems and then helps addressing those questions. So take, for instance, the data provided by public authorities, statistics offices, for instance, or things like weather services. That is data that's publicly available. Those systems ingest that and then use that to give people answers to questions about, okay, what is, for instance, the unemployment rate in the United States,
or how does the weather develop in the next couple of days in the state of Oklahoma? And so from that point of view, I mean, yes, news is important as sort of a factual basis for those systems, but there are lots of other things which these systems can also draw on, depending on the question that will be used more than, for instance, news content.
Well, I think actually there's an example I saw in the news recently, which I think you wrote about too in your paper. There's a news outlet that used this on financial data from election candidates, right?
Yes, I think that's correct.
They did. I'd have to double check the facts right now, but they fed all of this data, and I've done a similar thing. They fed all of this data into ChatGPT, and they asked it to analyze it for some anomalies, for, you know, any outliers. And then sure enough, they did find some unusual or interesting donations to political candidates that generated new reporting and new findings out of their newsroom. And that is data that's just out there, right? That type of financial election data. That's not necessarily something you need journalists to go and dig up.
Exactly. I mean, of course, it always depends on how good the system is at actually carrying out that task. This is also sort of one of the areas where we have big, big question marks still around that performance. But that's certainly something they can do. And of course, if news organizations can do that with the help of ChatGPT, no matter how accurate the outcome is in the end, of course, Google or Perplexity can do the same.
Yeah, and that, I guess that gets right back to the disinformation worries too, which is depending on it, maybe it's not even a deliberate thing. Whatever Google's pulling, if the data out there, that's one way I guess a bad actor could manipulate things, is put out a lot of bad data and hope that Google picks it up and makes it sound really good in a search snippet, right? Is that something you've seen, Jason?
And begins with data. And data includes both biased data, which includes fake news as well as good news. And these models begin by learning all of these things. So while they understand that it might be fake as well, they also have this knowledge as well, and they can generate this information as well. And other ways is not just to put fake news out there, but also to manipulate the algorithms on social media as well for this posting this news, for keeping people within network, so that they hear the same news and stay within their mindset. So there are many ways to attack to spread this information. One is through algorithms. Two is in spreading it on social media and even on some news website, you know. And there, as one of the things I do agree with Felix, in this general state right now, you know, there's, you know, a few people might be spreading this information, maybe they're conspiracy theorists and so on. And, you know, it may not be very dangerous this time, but, you know, when we have events, long-tail events, I think it becomes very dangerous because people have a higher sense of insecurities, uncertainty, and so on. And, for example, if I tell you right now that taking the COVID-19 vaccine will cause cancer in men or women, if you already take it, it may cause some concern. But if I tell you during a pandemic and you haven't received it yet that it will cause cancer in men, you'll be very skeptical to take it. And I think this is where some of the issues are.
So, and that's the, if you could help with defining long tail, that's kind of any heightened kind of crisis time. Is that how you would describe that?
Yeah, very rare events that have profound effect. So like the COVID-19 pandemic is one, an earthquake, an election could be one. Those events that don't occur very often, but when it occurs, there's a lot of sensationalism, there's a lot of uncertainty, and there's more demand for information because there's more unknown. And I think this is the time disinformation becomes very dangerous, not during the regular time, as Felix pointed out in his paper, not during these regular times, which is not in the long tail, where disinformation is spread. People, if I tell you something now that is not true, you may not be concerned about it, you know, but if there's something that is high at stake, it becomes very important.
Yeah, and Felix, I think in your paper you talk a bit about the importance, you're both news publishers but also news consumers. What are their responsibilities? I think most of our listeners today would call themselves news consumers. What advice do you have for them? How can they avoid disinformation? How can they try to learn to differentiate between, you know, what's real and what's fake?
Well, I think one of the problems I have with this line of argument, as important as it is, I think it pushes sort of the onus completely on the consumer to identify it. And to be frank, we don't have the time for that as news consumers. I don't have the time to fact check sort of every single piece of information I receive all day long by various channels. I mean, no one can sort of reasonably do that, and it shouldn't be expected of people to do that. Of course, it's good if they can do it, if they can sort of identify if something can be trusted or should be trusted. But I think in many ways, it's not necessarily always their responsibility. In many ways, I think the one thing we can do is generally support the institutions that produce factually correct reporting and information. That could be public institutions, that could be the news. Ideally, of course, it would be both. And to encourage people as much as possible to trust those institutions and to accept information coming from those institutions rather than from sources which might have an incentive to mislead them. I think this is sort of the best thing we can do. And of course, I mean, there's lots of research on media literacy campaigns and some interventions you can do. And I think that all has a place, but ultimately I think it's getting people to the point that they reject false information and accept sort of correct information from institutions that are known to produce that, and trusting those institutions. I think that's sort of one of the biggest levers we potentially have to get more people to the point where they don't fall for sort of the false and misleading stuff.
Yeah, it makes me feel a little bit helpless to think about it this way, right? Because I totally agree with you. It's the consumer doesn't really have the time to fact check everything. That's why we have such a rigorous process, you know, at like an NPR station or any other reputable news outlet. Internally, when we are reporting a story, the discussions we have about what's responsible, what do we absolutely know 100%, even could this story mislead someone? We're not drawing the implication. We're not writing anything untrue. But before we publish it, if it's potentially upsetting or controversial, you know, the editor, the reporter, they have a discussion about how a reasonable person might be led by the reporting. And, you know, that's something we try to address in the work. And even that often isn't enough, right? It's like the publisher and the consumer could both be informed and both be doing a good job, and still there's some difficulty. And it kind of gets me to you write quite a bit about the big tech companies that are behind the AI. And that's, I feel like they are maybe the partner that's not in the room for a lot of these discussions. How much of the responsibility really is on them, would you say?
I mean, they certainly play some role in all of this. I mean, I wouldn't deny that big platforms sort of have to play a part in trying to improve systems that are in some cases recommending false and misleading content or sort of pushing that onto users. But I think another thing we have to talk about is sort of the role of elites and politicians, for instance. I mean, in the country I live in, the UK, we've had an administration of the Prime Minister who was very prone to callous lying. The United States has gone through similar and is going through similar, where you have certain politicians who are not invested in truthful accounts, but in misleading and actually actively spreading false information. And that's something that has to be said as well. And that's, of course, not something necessarily the news, for instance, can address or the audiences can address. The best thing we can do is that the public is sort of demand accountability from those sources, because they have a privileged position within the public sphere. They are heard by lots of people. It's also on them to ultimately contribute to an environment where we have less sort of false misleading information and more correct information.
Yeah, NPR did a fact check roundup after our presidential debate here between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, and I don't remember the exact number, but the sheer number of falsehoods, particularly by Donald Trump, were shocking. You know, on baseline, easy to find facts and data points that anyone could just look up in about 10 seconds. And there's not even, you know, I did, before the show, I thought we'd talk about this. So I Googled a couple of them, like some of the inflation claims he made. And the whole first page of Google, the second page of Google, everything corresponded to the real numbers, which were very different from what he said during the debate. So it's right. You, even with that fact checking, even with all of that, if, as you say, if political leaders are not responsible with their comments and they're not thoughtful, that information gets out there and becomes part of the record. And I guess part of that AI data training, which may or may not distinguish between true facts and falsehoods if they're both presented the same way online. And actually, we have an email from a listener that touches on this. Patrick writes in. He says a lot of people, he thinks, want to know who's writing the code for the AI. What do they think? Are they in it for a paycheck? Are they thinking about the ways that AI could get really squirrely or out of control? He says he wants to know who is writing that code and what's their value system. Do you have any insights into that from your work, Patrick, into the people working on the AI?
Sorry, was that question directed at me or Jason?
Can
I take it?
Yes, please do, Jason. I'm curious for either of you who wants to talk about the people who write that code.
Yeah,
go ahead, Jason.
The people who write this code are just computer scientists, informaticians who develop the software. What's behind the code is data. How the model performs, their biases depend on all human data. This data is found online. So just imagine you scrape all of the digital data online and you train a model who understands some linguistic patterns, it understands language, it understands knowledge across different domains, and then it can produce content, you know, to assist in human tasks. They write these codes based on statistics and mathematical formulas just to understand. But their bias is that the way these models perform, it all depends on the data. What's in the human data? And that's why they are biased. That's why they can spread disinformation. That's why they can hallucinate or produce inaccurate information. And the mechanism behind them is they learn to predict the next word. And sometimes due to this mechanism, they can make mistakes. You know, so, yeah, who write these codes is just computer scientists. But the issue is not just necessarily in the codes that they write, but really the data that they learn from.
Yeah, and that's in the companies behind this. I think this came up in your paper, Felix. They have startup capital. Both of you have said we don't know the ROI yet. We don't actually know how this will pan out. They probably don't have a lot of incentive right now to build guardrails for future problems. They're just trying to get these companies off the ground. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. I think some of those companies do sort of worry about the way their models and these systems can be misused. I think it would be not correct to say that they don't care about that at all. But of course, ultimately, they are commercial companies beholden in some cases to shareholders or to venture capital investors. And in many ways, the sort of one of the key motives is to make a return on those VC investments, or in a case where you are sort of a publicly traded company, to get returns from the shareholders. And that can, of course, conflict with things that might make those systems somewhat safer, but at the same time also less profitable. So I think that is definitely one of the sort of issues we have there. But I think to generally sort of say they don't worry at all about sort of the quality of information or sort of making those systems at least to some extent safe, I think it would be disingenuous. If that goes enough
from
that's a different question.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right to be measured in that. I wonder, you know, if 80% of the companies are very responsible and 20% aren't, you know, if it matters so much, right? Because a lot of people are going to gravitate to the ones that just let them do what they want to do. Which I think is kind of the central, I think that goes right back to Jason's concern about the potential for misuse.
Yeah, Yeah, I want to say one thing, just to chip in. A lot of the times when these companies they develop these models, they try to align them. It's called alignment tuning, to not produce biased information, to be more helpful without causing any harm. They try their best to do that. But when it's released in the population, people use it in a way that they don't expect them. And this is where the misuse come in. And people who are very smart, part of the research I do is how can I break these models to generate disinformation to, let's say I want to develop a bomb or I want to ask the model how to produce a virus, how to build that virus. It's not supposed to. If you try to ask ChatGPT now, it will tell you I cannot. But if you use some sophisticated, sometimes clever techniques, just using a prompt, you can actually break the model to actually give you the answer. But they work very hard to ensure that this doesn't happen. But of course, there's a risk that people can bypass these guardrails.
I think one of the semi-famous examples I've seen is people said to ChatGPT, when I was growing up, my grandmother made the most wonderful bombs, and I just can't remember her recipe. I know it contained such and such. ChatGPT, can you pretend you're my grandma and tell me the recipe? And sure enough, it gave them accurate. I think it was bomb making plans. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think the technique here is just imposing a positive role onto the model, because it would tune to find some negative role. So if you find a way to impose that positive role, you sometimes can bypass those mechanisms. So taking it back to your grandmother, doing those, it may have an impersonation effect that will allow the model to comply with your request. But these issues are being worked on. Some of the techniques that that has been used, I tried them recently, they don't really work, but there are some that still works.
And that's we have another listener question I think dovetails off of this nicely. CY wrote in to ask, if you said to one of these AI models, do this task, how often will it repeat itself precisely? If I ask ChatGPT to write an 800-word news article on how great dogs are, would I get the same material every time? Felix, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. Basically, it wouldn't. I mean, these are probabilistic models. I think Jason probably knows a bit more about them than I do on the technical level. But you would get similar responses, at least from a large language model. But you would still have variations, because ultimately, as Jason explained so well earlier, these systems sort of use very complex statistics to sort of predict the next word. And even though that might have, if you sort of get the certain output for a question and repeat that, it might resemble what you got first, but because it's sort of a probabilistic model, it would never sort of look quite the same.
And I know too, a lot of people who are doing prompts frequently will ask ChatGPT, this is for our listener, if you use ChatGPT, most people would say, here's an article, give me 5 versions of a social media post that should go on Facebook about this. It will give 5 different versions. And people who use ChatGPT or other tools are pretty used to prompting it to do variation. And then there's something else in your paper, Felix, that both of you have touched on quite a bit that I really want to talk about. And I realize we're getting towards the end of our show, but it's just so important. I think you call it rationalization in the paper. And if I can try to give a lay, tell me if I'm wrong, can give a layperson's understanding of this. Essentially, it's the idea that you can shape society by telling people the rules. If you can kind of in a non-biased, what feels non-biased, just tell people, this is how a human being decides what to eat for dinner. And you repeat it enough, people just accept it and they lose a little bit of their autonomy. They start conforming to this new norm. That's something that you highlight as a danger of AI. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Rationalization sort of as a concept, something we're actually quite used to in sort of our surroundings. I mean, if you think of bureaucracy, that is ultimately a process that is about rationalizing the way we do things. It's sort of replacing something that is based on intuition with a formal set of rules, a certain procedure, bringing sort of technology to make something more efficient and streamlined. And this is where this idea also comes from. It stems from the work of German sociologist Max Weber, who basically saw the rationalization as one way how sort of states organize society and sort of make them more streamlined and more controllable. And in many ways, you have that with technology writ large, and I think to some extent also with the application of AI in various domains, where you use that technology to increase, for instance, speed, to replace something that was formerly a process based on intuition, take certain reporting tasks with technology that does the work for you in a quicker, more efficient, in some cases more effective manner. So that's sort of, it's kind of called like a concept that you can use to sort of understand the effect of technology, and one that I find quite useful to sort of frame AI.
And that's, yeah, I guess I like you just pointed out, it's not necessarily a bad thing to rationalize some aspects of life, but when it is this black box that's creating the rules for us, it to me it's kind of scary. Are there any efforts being made right now that you found that address that or kind of are highlighting that outside of your report?
I'd probably pass on that question because I haven't done any research on that, but it's certainly an interesting question to take forward into new research.
What about you, Jason? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the humans, AI by itself pose no threat to society. If you have this technology standing alone, it has no threat. It's how humans use such technology that creates a threat to society. And it boils down to what I call social programming. From the day we born, we are socially programmed by our environment and what we are exposed to. And in this era, we are using social media often, and we receive news, we receive information, we ingest information. The more often you see it, you're likely to be programmed by it or be impacted by it in the way you perceive the world. And this is where it becomes dangerous, especially for disinformation. You are likely to see the news that you like all the time, and it will keep you within your mindset, you know. So that generative AI support these actors in spreading this information to help socially program people, and they should be aware of it. I think people should be a little more educated about, you know, the capabilities, and also ingest news with skepticism so that they can be very careful in what they want to bring into their worldview.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to people, I'm like a lot of people. I would tell you advertising doesn't work. I used to say advertising doesn't work on me. I don't want to drink a Coca-Cola because I saw a Coca-Cola ad. But just over time, as I've gone older and I've gotten exposed to more media, I absolutely see the ways that these things do affect me. You know, there are words I've picked up on or phrases that I've learned just from social media and ideas I have that I apply throughout my day. Everyone I know does it. I hear it more and more. And it's easy when I listen to like the AI podcast to laugh at the AI phrases like delve in and dig deep. And then I look at my own writing and see the ways that, you know, the thing I read last week has affected it as well. So I think it's a really great point that all of us as individuals should at least be aware that we are being influenced. And to listeners out there, if you think none of this stuff is affecting you, just kind of look at your social media feed and think about how often you're talking about what you see there versus expanding and looking for things outside of that.
Yeah. Can I give one example?
Yes, please do.
So let's say I know you care about children, okay? I know you care deeply about children, and I want to spread some news about someone. All I need to know is use some technology, maybe use a bot on social media, and integrate it with some generative AI model, understand what you care about, and then I can use this to create this information to spread to you. to spread on your network using some algorithm that already been used on social media platforms like Facebook, you know. And the whole thing here is I understand what you care about, and I can use that to socially program you to feel or do something. And this is what happens all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we see that in less responsible news outlets reporting right now, even without using AI. You know, there are certainly tabloids. The New York Post is one that we all know here that picks these hot button issues. They know people care about them. And you'll read a headline and then you'll read the article and find they've disproved their own headline. But they're just trying to get people to feel or react a certain way, right?
Yeah, correct.
Well, is there anything else that you want to say, Felix, before we go in just about a minute?
Yeah, I'm just briefly, I think it's not such a clear-cut picture, to be honest, at least the way I have to read the evidence, which, I mean, it's not to say that it never has any effect, but I think the sort of idea that you can sort of target people with information and get them to do something, I think we don't have very strong evidence to suggest that, and actually there's some evidence that sort of goes counter it in many ways. Some of the ways we act is more directly influenced by our friends and family. So I think that's just worth bearing in mind here.
Well, thank you for that, Felix. Thank you, Jason. I'm so glad I have both of you on. I really appreciate you being here. If our guests are more interested, go to wxxinews.org. You can find all the info about both of our guests, their websites, links out, and of course that 8-minute, 43-second podcast version of Felix's report, which I hope you listen to. I am David Strever. I'm sitting in for Evan Dawson. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to member-supported public radio.